There's the plan, and then there are the unintended consequences of the plan. The United States talking diplomacy, then bombing Iran, hinting its targeting of nuclear sites might have been a one-off, but leaving the regime guessing over whether the actual objective is to overthrow the Iranian theocracy there. Will Washington own what's next after its biggest show of force since the occupation of Iraq? Iran responding in a kind with a rocket attack, not on the Strait of Hormuz, but at the U.S. base located across the Persian Gulf in Qatar. We'll get more on that in this conversation. Also, we'll be asking what the implications are for points like the Strait of Hormuz. And with Israel now hitting Tehran's Evin prison, it's clear this is more than just about nukes. What are Iran's options? And what will the consequences be if there is the overthrow of a militarized theocracy? Today in the France 24 debate, well, it's now Trump's war, and with us to talk about it from Washington, military historian Farzin Nadimi, senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy Think Tank. Thanks for being with us here on France 24.
Thank you for having me.
Barbara Slavin is distinguished fellow at the Stimson Center Think Tank. Welcome back.
Thank you very much.
John Arath is a senior policy director at the Center for Arms Control and Non-Proliferation. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for inviting me.
His postings included Syria, Saudi Arabia, and Jordan. Retired U.S. diplomat William Jordan with us as well. Good to see you.
Thanks a lot. My pleasure.
By the way, you can always listen, like, and subscribe to the France 24 debate wherever podcasts are streamed. 2 weeks certainly feels like 48 hours with this White House. Donald Trump had promised a fortnight to reflect and let diplomacy run its course. Then those B-2 bombers went, targeted Iran's main nuclear sites, including Fordo, deep underground. On day 11 of its war with Iran, Israel's hit Fordo again this Monday, as well as Tehran's Evin prison. Donald Trump still insisting a while ago before he went into a National Security Council meeting that he's not at all at war with Iran, all the while issuing over social media less than veiled threats about eventual regime change. And now, Farzin Nadimi, Iran responding with what it has called what it claims are devastating and powerful missile attacks, even giving its operation a name, calling it Annunciation of Victory. And Qatar, for its part, so far saying zero casualties. Your thoughts about Iran saying it is targeting Qatar and Iraq?
Well, it has been an ambition of Iran for years to have the opportunity to attack Al Udeid Air Base, but it's more or less a symbolic raid. It seems that even though a large number of ballistic missiles were used to attack Al Udeid, they knew that this base was largely empty. There were no airplane on the runways or the ramps, and there were very few personnel there. Therefore, it is very low-risk operation for Iran, but mainly a symbolic, conducted at night with missiles raining down on the air base, and to inflict some damage, and for as you said, for mainly for domestic purposes, and also to show the President Trump that they are determined to retaliate for the.
So
right?
Is this the same as in 2020 when after the U.S. Killed the head of the Revolutionary Guards, Qassem Soleimani, the Iranians through back channels effectively told the Americans they were going to target one of their bases outside of Baghdad?
More or less, yes. Well, however, according to General McKenzie, Iran did not send an official warning about their impending missile attack, but that was that was detected by U.S. ISR intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance assets and satellites, and personnel at Al Udeid were warned well before the missiles were about to arrive. This time it was again the case. Many personnel had already left, and the base was largely empty. So any strike that is caused will be inflicted on the infrastructure and on runways, and they will look good on satellite imagery, and Iran can use them as the evidence of their power.
So Barbara Slavin, the Qataris, by the way, the neighboring UAE as well, closing their airspace before this attack. Again, that could point to the fact that there could have been a heads up, either through intelligence services, as Farzin was saying, or from the Iranians themselves through back channels. But Qatar saying it reserves the right to respond directly and in accordance with international law. So what we just witnessed, a sign of de-escalation or a sign of escalation?
Well, to my mind, it is less serious than the response that the U.S. had to Soleimani's assassination. At that time, there were 100 Americans who suffered various sorts of brain injuries as a result of those strikes. And this time, I think it's pretty clear that there will be no casualties. So I find this to be very performative and symbolic. I agree with Farzin.
Very performative, very symbolic. Will Donald Trump read it that way?
I hope so. He has unfortunately gotten the United States in far too deep already. So if he accepts the fact that this is symbolic and performative, perhaps the United States can extricate itself. Otherwise, I think we're going to get in deeper and deeper, and it's going to be very hard to say where this goes.
Too deep already? There are no boots on the ground. Why do you say too deep already?
Because the United States should not have gotten into this fight. The United States should not have supported Israel in its decision to use military force to go after the Iranian nuclear program. As we speak, we don't know where 900 pounds of highly enriched uranium is. We don't know Iran's ability to reconstitute the program with centrifuges that are perhaps hidden in other places. And Iran now has an excellent reason to quit the nuclear nonproliferation treaty and rush for a bomb. All of this was unnecessary.
Do you agree with this, William Jordan?
We could have had a diplomatic deal.
Yeah, largely. Sorry? I agree. I think that the... what should have happened was that Trump, could have mobilized, as he was clearly trying to do performatively, the resources to be able to carry out the strikes that happened over the weekend in Iran, but use that as leverage in the negotiations that were being discussed to resume and tested the water, so to speak, given the Iranians a chance to come to the table and talk and explain what was going on, leave the Israelis to do whatever it was they felt that they needed to do, because I think that the dynamic of this situation is such that, you know, the war is going on between Israel and Iran, and so let Israel and Iran, as it were, duke it out. I think, in a way, Trump jumped the gun, and decided,
why did he jump?
Well, because I think he wanted to make a point. I think he wanted to demonstrate that he had the capability to be able to do this. Whether he actually had received, and this is the big question, did he receive some sort of information that he hadn't had before, indicating that there was a need to strike on the particular day at the particular time that he did? I am at a loss to figure out what that could possibly be, but he's basically cut off the possibility, in my view, of the Iranians being willing to come to the table to talk about any of this, whether with us, whether with the Europeans, because right now the way this looks is that the Europeans too have been somewhat complicit in all of this. It's a it is in a way, especially if this sort of show-off attack, you know, to show that to prove that the Iranians can fire ballistic missiles at El Udeid in Qatar, you know, that they could do other things. It suggests that we're back on the escalation ladder, and if you really get into a situation, I would have thought, for example, that if the Iranians really wanted to do something, they would have gone after the naval base in Bahrain, or the Houthis would have been going after
ships. Well, confirming what you're saying, William Jordan, is the New York Times, which is reporting that the Iran coordinated the attacks on the American airbase in Qatar with Qatari officials and gave advance notice that attacks were coming to minimize casualties. We'll see if that is corroborated. John Arath, so many questions. You're a former member of the National Security Council, so you know about these crisis situations. First of all, again, there was this last week. We're going to have 2 weeks to let diplomacy have a chance, and then that becomes 48 hours and Donald Trump's B-2 bombers strike. Was this the plan all along? Does this plan go way back? Or are these impulse kinds of things you can make on an impulse decision?
It certainly is not the sort of thing that I would advise making as an impulse decision. But it appears that that's exactly what happened.
What's the proof of that?
That the president had announced that there was a two-week time frame for the decision to be made, and then suddenly it was shrunk down to 2 days. I think that it's not a bad guess that there was some kind of information that presented some sort of target of opportunity, perhaps some sort of evidence that they were moving equipment from one of the nuclear sites, and that it was important to strike the sites before the equipment could be moved away, but that's pure guesswork. I don't know any more than anyone else what was going on or whether it was simply a case of feeling a urgency that didn't exist to strike them now.
The head of the UN's nuclear watchdog has asked Iran this Monday to let its inspectors back in. If you were Tehran, what would you say?
If I were Tehran, I would say absolutely go in and see that there's nothing that is illegal or illicit going on, assuming that that is the case. If I had something to hide, I would then try to hide it. But that's always been the case with Iran. They have never been completely candid or transparent with the IAEA inspectors. They've always done just enough to remain legally within the bounds of compliance and give the impression that they might just be hiding something. So I would probably continue that sort of policy.
Farzin Nadimi, do you agree with Barbara Slavin that Donald Trump is in over his head?
Well, I think President Trump will see this strike as it is, as a symbolic operation, just for the face value, and he will recognize that publicly and will announce that since there was no casualties and no significant damage, so we are just going to let it go.
All right, that's your prediction. What about the regime? What cards does it hold right now in its hand? We've seen that there have been, they've announced another arrest of a European spying for Israel. We know that there are reports of intimidation and arrests of bystanders coming to see the sites that have been bombed by Israel. What is the regime's focus, and what are its options?
Well, whenever they are put under pressure from external sources, they turn inward and further suppress their own people and the visitors and tourists, and arrest people and torture them and take forced confessions. And I think in these cases, it is classic Iranian regime. They just put more pressure on their own people, just just to deviate energy from their own defaults into their own people, and this is quite expected. What they will do? They will try to now. Both Iran and Israel are racing against time. Iran is trying to force Israel into a ceasefire by inflicting as much casualties and damage as possible, using the dwindling number of missiles they can fire at Israel. At the same time, Israel knows that they have to wrap up their operation at some point, and they are trying to maximize the number of gains that they can achieve given this limited period of time that they have. Now most of the Iranian nuclear sites have been destroyed, and most of the missile sites have been attacked, but probably not. And many of them are still able to launch missiles, obviously. So Israel might want to spend a few more days to strike Iranian military targets and then call it a day.
And then call it a day? Is that how you see it, William Jordan?
Well, for now.
Well, not necessarily. I mean, again, the Israeli operations are still going on, and there's no real clear idea what the timeline for Israel's continued activities is.
Because there's military reasoning and there's political reasoning.
So. Well, and I think the Israelis are operating more on the base. I mean, there's obviously a whole political thing playing out in Israel that involves Benjamin Netanyahu and what he's trying to do to maintain power using this war and everything else that's going on in the region to his political advantage. But I think that essentially, at heart, you know, it's basically a military campaign that's being waged by the Israeli military with pretty precise objectives. They've got a plan. They're operating on the basis of a plan. And I think that, again, it's one of these situations where if I were Donald Trump, and I were considering what to do, I would hope that my military was basically telling me, okay, there's really, you know, we haven't yet crossed a threshold where American blood has been shed or significant American interests have been attacked. We should hold our fire. We should continue, but we should work with the Israelis more closely. We should probably start sharing, if we're not already doing so, our own intelligence about ballistic missile launchers and things like that, the capabilities that Iran has to deploy to mount more serious attacks, and look at where we can go after either proxies or other forces that Iran might bring to bear and be prepared to deal with those, but basically stay out of this fight for the moment unless and until it ratchets up. I mean, what I was worried about when I first heard about these missiles coming in was that it was going to be in significant number, that some of them would get through, would actually hit important targets, would kill or wound American service people. And then you would start to get into this temptation to do what Trump, I don't give Trump a lot of credit for anything, but when he has attacked, as he did in Syria in 2017 or 2018 against a CW site, he did not follow the game plan that Barack Obama was planning to use in 2013 when his famous red line was crossed and carpet bomb basically Syria to take out its air defense and command control systems as well as its CW facilities. He decided to take a surgical approach and attack very precisely. He did that over the weekend. Again, he's in over his head. He shouldn't have done it. He played a high card he didn't need to play when he played it. But the thing is, to avoid getting into exactly the kind of escalatory situation we've seen so many times in American history, including Vietnam, where it leads to, again, this temptation to carpet bomb and to go to overkill in order to make a point in response, I think this is way too soon. Let the Israelis continue to do their dirty job for us.
Barbara Slavin, two questions. First of all, the overkill is a temptation. The Israelis control Iranian airspace. We have one report of a military base in the north this Monday that was flattened by the Israelis, and they did three flyovers to finish the job, which means that it was pretty comfortable conditions for their pilots. The temptation is there for the overkill that William Jordan describes.
Yeah, I guess so. But as I said before, we do not know where 900 pounds of enriched uranium have gone. There were a lot of reports that canisters, metal canisters, left Fordo and Isfahan prior to the American strikes. I would think that that would be priority number one, to find out where the fissile material has gone, rather than to widen this conflict and drag the United States further into this war.
Before I get back to Barbara, let's go to Tehran and our correspondent, Saeed Azimi. Saeed, you were telling us before that there was a certain amount of choreography surrounding this operation by Iran directed towards the Aludair base in Qatar. The New York Times is now reporting, quoting three Iranian sources, that there had been advance warning given.
Of course, Francois, they had emptied the airbase. And right now, the updates that we have from Tehran is the statement from the IRGC, from the armed forces of Iran, saying that they have responded definitively and strongly and successfully. And another statement from the Supreme National Security Council of Iran, saying that the number of missiles fired at Aludeid airbase was the exact same number of Iranian of the American bombs that were dropped on Iranian nuclear sites. That means there were 14 missiles. And interestingly, both these statements only claim responsibility for Iran firing missiles at Aludeid airbase. So in other terms, Iran is saying that if any other U.S. base in the region is targeted, it's not us, it's other groups. And Ayatollah Khamenei recently stated that Iran can fight its own battles. It doesn't need proxies in the region.
And Saeed Azimi, at this point in time, is there are there official statements calling for dialogue, or are they digging in?
Oh, no, no, no. I think, Francois, there is no call. There is no official call for dialogue at the moment. Russia's Vladimir Putin told Iran's foreign minister Abbas Araghchi today that Russia is ready to help, but he didn't specify what kind of help he means, diplomatically, militarily, supplying Iran with weapons or something else. I think there is a silver lining in a diplomatic channel. Credible sources in the foreign ministry told me that after Russia, Iranian foreign minister will travel to an Arab country, to an Asian country, and a European country. They weren't very specific about it, but my guess is China, Saudi Arabia, or Oman, and regarding a European country, I'm guessing Italy or Netherlands.
Saeed Azimi, many thanks for joining us live here in the France 24 debate. It's interesting listening to this call for try to kickstart diplomacy. John Arad, I'll put it to you, because earlier we had a joint press conference. The French president is right now in Oslo, and between Prime Minister Gura and President Macron of France, and both of them said, A, that this is not NATO territory, so they don't want to be drawn into it. B, that the risk of escalation is clearly obvious, and saying it is a violation of international law, what the United States did. At this point in time, what are the optics going into that NATO summit that's taking place Wednesday in the Netherlands?
The optics, of course, are not very good for the United States. But it's not so much that it's a violation of international law that is significant in Washington. It's a violation of U.S. law. The U.S. Constitution very clearly states that it is a prerogative of Congress to declare war, and the War Powers Act of 1973 requires the president to consult and get the approval of Congress before taking action, exactly like this one. That's why it was enacted, so that the presidents would have to get the approval of Congress before taking actions like this. so that there would not be this tendency of presidents to act alone and without advice from the legislative body. But that's exactly what has happened. And I think there's going to be considerable debate in the coming days and weeks on Capitol Hill. And it's going to get very political in Washington about exactly how U.S. law would have applied.
But aren't there blurred lines when it comes to the War Powers Act? The U.S. has been pounding the Houthis in Yemen for months now. They didn't ask Congress.
The Houthis have been pounding the U.S. ships in the Red Sea, so that that gives a convenient excuse to hit them back. In this case, there was no attack on U.S. forces or personnel. Now, the White House will probably say that there was some sort of imminent danger from Iran possibly being able to assemble a nuclear weapon in a short period of time, but they're going to have to produce that evidence and make a case for what it was that they acted upon. That is going to be very interesting to see, because it is going to set some precedents. And if the Republicans are going to say that their president acted based on certain facts on the ground, then that's going to set the president a precedent for future presidents. Sorry for the tortured English.
No, it's okay. We're looking at the on those dots are the places where the U.S. has military forces. William Jordan, the United States does not do half measures. There are more than 40,000 U.S. military personnel in the Gulf.
Way too many, in my view. But they're there, and they're. I'm not going to say they're vulnerable, but they.
40,000.
Well, again, the successive administrations, and especially during the first Trump administration, remember, a lot of these troops were in the region to fight the Islamic State, and then as Donald Trump proclaimed victory over the Islamic State, I think it was in 2018, John Bolton, who was then his national security advisor, recalibrated everything and turned it into basically. The need to have a significant American presence throughout the region in order to counter Iran. And so, in a way, and Joe Biden didn't do much to alter that dynamic. He pretty much left the troops. He pretty much left everything in place. And so, yes, you have this infrastructure and you have this presence that's, in a way primed for this kind of conflict. I don't think, there was always a question as to whether or not, because it's been out there for a long time, to what extent would the United States ultimately let Israel drag it into another regional war? And that spanned, successive presidents going back and forth.
So if this is a one-off, if Saturday's strikes were a one-off, does then that question raised by John Arad about whether or not it's legal under the United States law to have done so without consulting Congress, does that just become a moot point, or is it?
No, I don't think it's a moot point at all. I don't know how it ends up being. I don't, in as much as there is, the Trump administration is itching to find across the board every opportunity in court to challenge the numerous laws dating back to the 1970s that restrained the power of the presidency and created independent agencies and independent, officials within the executive branch that were not subject to the whims of the executive, largely in order to hold in check the overwhelming executive power. But as far as the War Powers Act is concerned, there hasn't been a major case, as far as I know, brought specifically about the War Powers Act before the Supreme Court. Whether this ultimately proves to be such a thing, I really don't know. But, even before the War Powers Act, I'm just even remembering going back to the Gulf of Tonkin incidents that led to the Gulf of Tonkin resolution that gave Lyndon Johnson's administration carte blanche in Vietnam, that there were significant consultations on Capitol Hill in order to bring congressional leaders on board. I mean, ultimately, that did result in a vote. I think that the administration still rests on this flimsy, increasingly flimsy read of the, I can never remember what it actually stands for, but the authorities, the AUMUF, that goes back to, you know, the post 9/11 period under George W. Bush. That has never been formally rescinded. That has never been formally repealed or changed. And the you know, that would be the flimsy read that I think the administration would rest its case on.
Right. In this case. Now, despite Iran's parliament approving an eventual closing of the Strait of Hormuz, the markets unfazed. The price of crude in New York down slightly at the opening bell. By the way, Farzin Nadimi, the markets, well, believing those reports that Iran did this more for show than anything else, the price of crude has slipped further in the last minutes. And even though, as we can see, that's the Strait of Hormuz there, 20% of the planet's oil and gas transit through the strait. The water is only 60 meters deep. It's the exit path for tankers from Saudi Arabia, Iraq, and much more. And particularly, and you see the South Pars gas field there, which is split between Iran and Qatar. It's a particular problem for China, which gets 45% of its oil. Its number one provider is Russia, but number two, it all goes through the Strait of Hormuz, whether it's from Saudi Arabia, other Gulf states, or Iran. The Chinese, would you be fair to say that they've been perhaps more strong in their wording than the Russians even?
Well, for China, it's very important to maintain freedom of navigation and access to the Gulf oil. And I'm sure that they have made it clear to the Iranians that they want to be able to continue navigating through the waterway. So any blanket Iranian measure like mining, sea mining, is just out of consideration. I believe if Iranians decide to disrupt the shipping, that's all they will do by moving their speedboats around and creating an unsafe environment for shipping to operate, but at the same time giving green light to Chinese shipping companies to continue sending their tankers to load. At the same time, like in 2019, we might see some cases of unattributed attacks against Western tankers or other commercial shipping in the region. I think that will be it. Because if Iran wants to go too far, if Iran wants to close the Strait of Hormuz, and all the bad things that will happen to Iran's own economy aside, they will invite in the wrath of the U.S. Military, and it's quite possible that this administration will decide some punitive actions against Iranian and naval units and naval bases in the region.
Now, is China just a spectator in all of this? How far would China go to bat for Iran?
I don't think any more than some intelligence offering. China has had some relations with the Houthis. They, in the past, they have provided them with some equipment to help with their military industries to keep their weapons operational, and some components for the drone industry. But other than that, I don't think China will be one to be involved in this crisis.
On Sunday, the U.S. Secretary of State tweeting a request to China. Tell Iran to please not block the Strait of Hormuz. Marco Rubio is saying, I would encourage the Chinese government in Beijing to call them about that because they heavily depend on the Strait of Hormuz for their oil. What was your reaction? This was something, I was in a tweet actually, it was an interview with Fox News. What was your reaction to that, Barbara Slavin?
Well, obviously the United States wants to limit the economic consequences of this war to make sure that the price of oil does not skyrocket and upset Trump's plans to reduce inflation, to see interest rates go down in the United States. So I think that's what that was about. Chinese have put out some rather strong statements, and I think they are trying to do some mediation behind the scenes. But I'm not sure that the United States will listen to them.
Of course, China has a military base in Djibouti, and it's never gotten
China
involved militarily,
not, though. No, China is not a military power in the Persian Gulf. There's no way that's going to happen. It's still the United States, as you pointed out with your excellent chart showing all the bases where Americans are located. One thing I'm looking for is whether Iran's partners, the Iraqi militias, the Houthis, others get involved. So far, they've not. Iran has decided that it must respond directly for these strikes upon the Iranian homeland. And I think that's also a good sign.
Just a quick question on one last question on this. China, which now had a first freight delivery at the end of last month going from Iran to China through Central Asia. There's still a lot of problems with it because sending their oil by land rather than by sea, apparently the tracks are different sizes when you go to the Central Asian republics. But still, Barbara Slavin, again, if the Chinese were able to get their oil from Iran by land, what would that change? And is that something Donald Trump thinks about?
I think that's a long way in the future. There's been a lot of talk about improving these kinds of connections between the Chinese and Iran and you know, going through Central Asia to Europe. But that's a lot of this is a long way in the future. And as you pointed out, oil moves much more easily on tankers.
All right. So it brings us back to what you were saying, how those proxies will act. William Jordan, Iranians, they're deliberate in their response. They've even said so, that they would. Will the other shoe drop later? And if so, how?
I think so. In fact, this morning, in another context, I was commenting, basically saying that I thought that the Iranians would probably exercise a certain amount of strategic patience. You know, would not stop complaining about what was happening. Would not take their case to as they've done to Russia, to other allies, to other countries, to basically berate the Europeans for their stance. So I don't know, you know, to what extent. I think what's interesting is that if I'm remembering correctly, and we talked a bit about this before with the Soleimani assassination. I mean, there are two aspects of that that made it so so significant. I mean, one was, of course, the killing of Soleimani, but as well as the fact that he was killed on Iraqi territory, which meant that it was impossible for Iraqis allied with Iran to ignore it. But in the end, the Iranians basically, after an initial flourish of allowing an initial flourish of a reaction, let the circuit apparently go dead. And as was said, they started looking at assassination attempts or other things like that. I think that, you know, if you want to go way back in history, I mean, the Iranians, you know, tended to apply a sort of attitude that they would strike somewhere where it was least expected. At a time when nobody was thinking anymore about what the Iranian threat was. But everything is going to depend on how the Israeli campaign continues to play out, whether there's anything that seems to draw the United States back in. And ultimately, I hate to keep saying it, Donald Trump's mind as far as how he feels he needs to respond, because it matters to him, not so much because it's a rational, calm, logical response based on the facts as presented to him.
John Erath, the Iranian response, will it be things like through proxies? You heard Barbara Slavin talk about proxies, something akin to the Buenos Aires embassy bombing or will it be terror attacks? Will it be something else?
Barbara knows much more about this than I do. But there are examples of this sort of thing in the past, and I would not discount that there is a considerable amount of strategic patience involved. And the U.S. bases in the region are hard targets. They are well protected and have high security that is on very high alert right now. So it could very well be that the Iranians will wait until they see an opportunity to strike at a softer target.
And Farzin,
that could be a considerable time in the future.
Farzin Nadimi, those proxies, we've seen how degraded now Hezbollah is. We've seen the Houthis are on the defensive. Does Iran still have the same proxy network that it did a year ago?
No, not at all. Houthis are the only ones that can offer the slightest amount of help at Bab el-Mandeb and the Red Sea. But in general, Iran can no longer rely on its proxies, at least for the considerable amount of time into the future. And therefore, they will, in my opinion, they will invest in their own missile forces, strategic weapons, if possible, nuclear weapons, but probably if they can. They will again try to rebuild their military, some parts of their military industries, again invest in some missile production, try to build missiles so they can restore their strategic depth using their strategic, whatever that remains of their strategic weapons and whatever they can produce into the future.
All right. Before we go, it was seen in Tel Aviv this Monday, a billboard display to thank the president of the United States, flattering for sure if Donald Trump sees it. Barbara Slavin, this thank you, Mr. President billboard that we're seeing, does that point to the fact that many believe it is Benjamin Netanyahu calling the shots here? Is that all it takes, a billboard to convince Donald Trump?
Well, every American president before Donald Trump rejected Israeli pleas to join this fight against Iran in this kind of kinetic way. Trump is the first. And so this will be his legacy, I think, as much as it will be Bibi Netanyahu's, depending on how this war turns out.
And it is could be a long war. Is Donald Trump ready for this? And will he silence critics within his own camp?
He's not a patient man. He may lose patience with this war and pivot. One never knows. Only he. And probably he doesn't know right now.
Okay. We'll leave it there, Barbara Slavin. We're talking about, always a pleasure to hear you talk about known unknowns from Washington. I want to thank as well Farzin Nadimi, John Arant, William Jordan. Thank you for being with us here in the France 24 debate.
Thank you very much.